Okay, this is the 912 teleconference for June 25th, 2014. Craig, please follow up.
Yeah, what I'll do is I'll read what the people I know for sure are on the call, and then if anybody that I don't name, you can tell me after. Also, if anybody wants to tell me if they want a particular group affiliation or some description next to their name in the minutes, just let me know that too. Usually I put, you know, the people that I already know, I've already got affiliations for them. But okay, so I have myself, Craig McKee, Ken Freeland.
Okay.
What's that?
We're getting a background whistle from somebody.
Yeah.
This isn't a good time to mute, but I'll tell you how to mute in just a minute.
Okay. So I have Craig McKee, Ken Freeland. I have Andy Steele. And I have Elizabeth Woodworth, James Hufford, and Cheryl Curtis. So who don't I have?
Bart Cruz, hi. Boston 911 Truth.
Diana Castillo with DC 911 Truth.
Okay, hold on. Let me just get Diana down first. Okay, who else did I hear speak up?
Oh, it's Barton Bruce, Boston 911 Truth, or AE 911 Truth Cable Team, or lots of other things, but those are the obvious ones.
Okay, great.
Humoop 911 TV.
Sorry, what was the name?
Humoop, H-U-M-M-U-X.
Okay, H-U-M-M-U-X.
911 TV.
Okay, so it's just the one name?
That's correct.
If you look in the list of people you say you're normally sending the announcement to, you'll find Hamook's name there.
Okay, terrific. Okay, anybody else?
Yeah, Michael Burke.
Sorry?
Yeah, Ned Delaney.
Ned Delaney, okay, I heard that in there. Who else?
Dave Hooper's on the call.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Andy and Cheryl and everybody. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Hi. Hi, Dave.
Yeah. And this is Wayne Costi. Wayne! Yeah, and,
how
and
do you
I'm
spell your last name again, Wayne?
C-O-S-T-E, Costi. C-O-S-T-E. And you can call me A-E, and I'll live in truth.
A-E, great. Okay, do I have everybody?
Mike Booth. Indiana Grassroots.
Okay.
Hi, Mark.
Hey.
Okay, anybody else I haven't heard from?
Yeah, Mark.
Gregory Donwell will be joining us in a second.
Sorry, I didn't quite get that. Say that again.
Greg Longo, L-O-N-G-O, will be joining us soon.
Well, he has to, yeah. That's good to know, but he has to check in when he comes in, okay, so that we catch.
Mark McDonald, Houston 911 Truth.
Mark McDonald, okay. Is that MC or MAC, Mark?
MC. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, anybody else?
Yep, Don Fox, I'm on the call now as well.
Oh, hi, Don.
Welcome back.
Great.
Okay, Greg, would you read the roll one more time then of the people that you have? I'd just like to get a count.
Yeah, sure. Ken Freeland, Craig McKee, Don Fox, Andy Steele, Elizabeth Woodworth, David Hooper, James Hufford, Cheryl Curtis, Diana Castillo, Barton Bruce, Hummux, Ned Delaney, Wayne Costi, Mike Booth, Mark McDonald. And that's what I have.
Well, okay. I think one of them probably dropped off right now, but that's okay.
Did I mention Ned Delaney? Yeah. Yeah, I think I did.
If anybody would like to, in the course of the teleconference, to mute your phone so that your background noise doesn't come in, the way to do that is to hit star and then 6, and then you unmute it the same way by hitting star 6. That'll only mute your voice. It won't what you're listening to, okay? All right, so this is the 9/11 Truth Conference for 6/25/14. Ken Freeland facilitating. Before we start, I'd just like to pay tribute to the people who were on the last call. We had a kind of an empty roster for a change, and people really brainstormed and came up with some really good ideas and did their homework. And as a result, I think we have a very informative teleconference ahead of us tonight. I want to welcome all the new people who are on the call and all our special guests. So with no further ado, let's look at the draft agenda very quickly that was circulated. Does anybody have any amendment to the draft agenda? Okay, hearing none, then we'll use that for our agenda this evening. And also we need to affirm the minutes from the previous meeting that were circulated by Craig. Any amendments to the minutes from the previous meeting, previous teleconference? Okay, hearing none, then the minutes are approved, and we can go right into part one, as soon as I can bring it up here. Well, that would be Elizabeth Woodworth. Elizabeth, of course, needs no introduction to people on this call. She's been a frequent participant. She's co-founder of the 9/11 Truth Consensus Panel, and is here to update us on some new consensus points that have been reached, as well as maybe a few other developments within the organization. Elizabeth?
Yes, thank you, Ken. Just to be clear, we're the 9/11 Consensus Panel.
What did I say?
I think you added the word truth in there, which
is
fine.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
But and the website is consensus911.org. And we now have 40 consensus points that have been developed by 24 experts over the past 3 years that refute official claims that were made about 9/11. That's all we do. We refute official claims. So we've done 40 points, and as I say, like since the spring of 2011. And our last 3 points have been, a number of people have said our last 3 points, which are on all on World Trade Center 7, are the most powerful points that we've released to date, including Paul Craig Roberts, who put them up on his website, and then he said that World Trade Center 7 controlled demolition was now a certainty or something like that. So I've been tweeting that all over the place. And so I can just tell you what they are. The first one, you've probably heard about the business of the fact that NIST in its analyses, it never actually gave the collapse model, you know, the computer simulation, but they've been saying how the building, how the collapse initiation started, and this is all quite complex engineering detail, and I'm not really competent to explain it to you, because there are panel members that wrote the point up who are engineers, but the main thing about this model is that it left out points. It left out structural components that in 2011, a man called David Cole did a Freedom of Information request, and he got all the drawings for World Trade Center 7. And he saw that there were pieces in there, beams and stiffeners and plates that were not included in NIST analyses. And so then he got in touch with Tony Zambotti, and Tony looked at it and he said, yes, if those pieces were in place, the beginning of the collapse initiation would never have happened. It would have been impossible from an engineering standpoint. So that's one consensus point, and it's fairly complicated, but the other thing is that I think it's architects and engineers have taken this information and they've hired a lawyer to I think they're going to try and sue NIST to explain why were these pieces missing, and do you agree that if they were there, the building could not have fallen as you said so? So that's going on. I don't know how many of you are aware of this. Is this well known, or is it new?
I was aware of it. Probably others with 8911 Truth Connection are aware of it.
Yeah. I was aware of it.
So,
Sorry, Elizabeth, who is Tony Zamboni?
Oh, he's an engineer, a mechanical engineer, and he's a member of Architects and Engineers, and he joined the 9/11 consensus panel about 6 months ago. And he's a very articulate, clear thinker. He's good, a really good man.
He's one of the speakers on the video, so you've seen him before.
Sorry?
This is Andy Steele. Tony Zambodi's an expert speak out. He is a member of AE911 Truth. I think he was on the board. I'm not sure if he is right now or not. Wayne could probably answer that. I know the guys that actually made the discovery about the stiffener plates and all of the incorrect data in the NIST report. And they actually, the attorney that they hired is William Pepper. He's the guy that was able to successfully represent the Martin Luther King family in a civil suit, and without knowing every single detail of that suit, essentially the jury came back and ruled that James Earl Ray was not the shooter, and it was likely a bigger conspiracy. You can look that up for yourself, but he's the guy who was responsible for that. He's the one who's taken that under his wing now. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
And he is a member of our 9/11 consensus panel. He's an honorary member. He knows David Griffin. And they know each other, I should say. So
Elizabeth?
Yes.
This is Ned Delaney. I just read, or just received an email tonight from A&E that they're considering preparing to sue CNN in reference to coverage of Freedom Center. But that's kind of an off from Building 7. But are they preparing potentially two different suits?
I don't know. I just got that. I haven't even opened it, but I saw it in my it came in at 4:48, same the one you saw about AE911 Truth slandered by CNN. And I don't know, that's new.
This is Andy Steele. I just want to say, to answer that question, the actions regarding the incorrect data is being handled by this independent group that working kind of closely with AE, but as far as I know, and Wayne can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but this independent group here is the ones that are heading this up and considering the lawsuit, and AE is just kind of providing publicity support and I guess their expert analysis too if it comes to that for coming into court. So I just wanted to throw that in there. Over.
Yeah, Wayne here. That's correct. That it is an independent group that's doing it, and we're looking to support them and trying to find out just the magnitude of the risk when you start to litigation. You know, it's easy to start and hard to complete sometimes.
Sometimes it's good to have insurance for that too. You know, when you start something like that, to get insurance. For slap suits and stuff.
Yeah.
So shall I go on with the next point?
Yes, please.
Okay, the second one, the first one was called WTC-75, if you go to the consensus points, if you want to read them. The second one is WTC-76, the fraudulent NIST claim that there was no steel recovered from building WTC-7 for analysis. And this just gets them, this is the best one, it just gets them absolutely cold. They said in about 6 reports, we were not able to recover any steel from World Trade Center 7. This 47-story steel frame high skyscraper came down and there was no steel that we could get. So we have a picture of Dr. John Gross, who was in charge of analyzing the steel, standing beside a pile of World Trade Center 7 steel and pointing to one of the pieces that the professors from the Worcester Polytechnic Institute said they could never understand why the steel was wafer thin. that steel that had been an inch thick. It was wafer thin. It had holes in it like Swiss cheese. It was curled like paper. And this, all this information came out about the World Trade Center 7 steel in a FEMA report in 2002 before NIST got its hands on the job of explaining all this. So NIST basically denied that there was any World Trade Center 7 steel to examine, but they made a few mistakes. They actually, one of them was really silly. They actually cited the FEMA report that had a photograph of this paper-thin Swiss cheese steel. So they're caught right there in a contradiction. But the best contradiction is looking at Dr. John Gross on the pile. He's got his hard hat on and his blue jeans, and he's up on this pile, and he's actually holding the beam. And that was another photograph that came out of a recent, fairly recent FOIA request.
Yeah, this is Dave Hooper here, and for what it's worth, that picture is going to make it into the film in its final edits before it comes out in September for The Anatomy of a Great Deception.
What are they going to do?
I got the picture from Richard Gage, and it goes beautifully with the scene that we've got him talking. I think it's University of Colorado. It's where he kind of caught himself in a lie, and then we're going to add those pictures. So those are great find.
Yeah. So I'm really glad you got that in your movie, David, because it's so incriminating. There's really nothing they can do about that now. I could go through that point, but I probably won't say any more about it right now. I could just read our conclusion. By denying this evidence, more than ample evidence shows that NIST's claim that no steel from World Trade Center 7 was found is false. By denying this evidence, NIST could claim that there was no evidence that the building had been brought down by explosives. So it positioned itself to explain the collapse by resorting to a computer simulation into which variables could be inserted at will. And there was no peer review. So by doing that computer simulation that was not peer reviewed, they were able to come up with a simulation that they could publish. It's all really shabby and shoddy. Now, there's one more point that I've got. Graham McQueen is our expert on foreknowledge. He's looked into all the reports from the firemen that were the oral histories that were published in the New York Times about 2006. I think the New York Times did a Freedom of Information request, and they managed to get they did interviews of hundreds of firemen, oral interviews, and they were supposed to be confidential, you know, not released. But they are released, and they're on there's a link on the New York Times website that you can Google. So Graham, who's in Canada too, he's a professor, retired professor emeritus of peace studies. He's written a lot about what these firemen reported, and now he's written a consensus point, and which starts by saying that on September 11th, many people knew well before WTC-7 collapsed that this 47-story high-rise building was going to come down. There were even two premature announcements of the collapse on major television networks. So how can we explain this? And the official account, there were two. They actually had an early account that the building was critically damaged by flying debris from the Twin Towers, and this caused structural damage and fires, which were especially large and hot because there was diesel fuel stored in that building. But they had to abandon that because there wasn't enough flying debris to down a 47-story steel frame building. So they moved over in 2008 when they did their final report. They moved over to a second official account, which is that the building came down primarily due to fire. And they acknowledged it was the first time in history that a steel frame high-rise had collapsed due to fire. And then they cited the sequence of events that we talked about in the collapse initiation point that I started with. So then another way of defeating this is through the observations of people who were there. And so the best, Graham has got together all the best evidence, and he's got, it's incredible. And you've probably seen this. It's not necessarily new, but the strength of our points are that they've been peer-reviewed in a blind process where none of the 24 reviewers get to see what the others are saying. So there's no influence. This is what's used in medicine. When to get the best evidence in medicine, they use the same process where they send out drafts of evidence and they ask maybe a dozen people or 20 people to look at it without talking to each other. They each have to make up their own mind. So there's no intimidation or more powerful personalities dominating, that kind of thing. So when we're finished with our points, they've been through three rounds of feedback and then incorporating that feedback, sending it back out again. And at the end of that process, we have the best evidence that can be got on the particular issue. And this is why the media is terrified of the consensus panel. They will even go so far as to shut down comments on a big newspaper if the consensus panel posts a point. That's happened to me. It happened with the National Post just a couple of months ago. I posted a consensus point. As soon as I posted it, they closed comments. They didn't print it. They obliterated it and they closed comments. So, and they know that this is a powerful model. So Graham's point, if you want to go and look at it, it's point WTC7, foreknowledge of the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7. And it's, I can just give you the conclusion. This foreknowledge must have come from people who intended to bring the building down. It corroborates the evidence and conclusions presented in previous points that we've already processed, including, and we always name them like WTC7 and then -1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that kind of numbering. So that's about all I have to say about that.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Unfortunately, we have pretty much run out of time for this issue since we have so many others to discuss tonight. Unless anybody has a really burning question or need for some real clarification here, I'd like to ask that we thank Elizabeth and move on to the next item. But does anybody have anything that really, really needs to be clarified here?
This is Dave Hooper. Only that, Elizabeth, I'd like to reach out to you in the next few days and have a private conversation.
Sure. You can email me at the consensus panel.
I know how to. I'll get a hold of you. Don't worry about it. I'll figure it out.
Okay.
I know where you are.
I'm glad. I'll be glad to be in touch with you. Thanks.
All right, great.
Well, thank you again, Elizabeth, for your always informative and inspired presentation, because the bigger the consensus gets around 9/11, the more powerful the testimony that it has to offer.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate the chance to explain these things.
Okay, the next item on our agenda will be the use of nuclear explosives in 9/11. That thesis will be presented by Don Fox, and Craig will give a brief introduction. Go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, hi. Sorry, my computer just shut off on me, so I do not have it. I'm going to have to wing it. But yeah, Don is a regular at Veterans Today, and one of the issues that he's written about most extensively is his belief that there was a nuclear element to the destruction of all three World Trade Center towers. And Don can correct me, but I believe he mentioned in his notes to me that he has done research, or he has followed the research of Dmitry Kalazov and also Jeff Prager, and there was a third name which now escapes me, but hopefully he can tell us about that. And yeah, so he has
So he's going to give us a little presentation on why he believes that nuclear devices were used on 9/11. So over to you, Don.
Okay, thanks for the introduction, Craig. And thanks for everybody for listening in. This might get a little dull in spots, but that's kind of where the rubber hits the road with 9/11 Truth. And probably what I'll do here is I'll email my notes over to Craig, and then if anybody wants them, I guess you could get a hold of him.
Sure.
But with that, I'll just start rattling on here. I planned on going about 20 minutes or so, and then if anybody has questions, they can go ahead and let me have it after I'm done here.
If you could shorten that just a bit so that you leave a little bit more time for questions, because we've only got about a little 25 for this thing anyway. So
All right.
Keep it more closer to 15 and leave more time.
All right. I'll we'll try to condense it down then a little bit. Okay, guys.
Okay.
So as we know, the debate has raged for more than a decade about what caused the Twin Towers' destruction on 9/11. The gross observable evidence demonstrates that huge amounts of energy were required to demolish the towers. The question then becomes, what was the source of that energy? And if you see things the way I do, the evidence clearly points to nuclear bombs as being the main source of the energy. Russian intelligence has recently leaked info that confirms the findings of researchers such as the anonymous physicist Dmitry Kolosov, Jeff Prager, Ed Ward, and myself, that indeed 9/11 was a nuclear event. And while the nuclear demolition theory isn't widely accepted, it's starting to gain steam in the research community and ultimately will be proven correct as irrefutable scientific evidence supports it. The more info that comes out, the more the nuclear demolition hypothesis is confirmed. So just real quick, what do we need to explain about the destruction of the Twin Towers? Well, the Twin Towers were destroyed in 9 and 11 seconds, respectively. That's two 500,000-ton, 110-story skyscrapers pulverized in midair. Extremely rapid onset of the collapse, in quotes. Destruction proceeds through the path of greatest resistance at near free fall speed. 90% of the debris lands outside the building's footprints. There was no stack of pancakes, as expected in a gravitational collapse. The buildings were destroyed from the top down and the inside out, with debris being ejected upward and outward. And we see pyroclastic flow, base surge, and mushroom clouds. A series of huge explosions precedes the destruction of each tower. Two chunks of debris were ejected up at a 300-ton chunks of debris were ejected up at a 45-degree angle and out 603 feet from the North Tower into the Winter Garden. One-third of the towers were completely vaporized into a cloud of fine dust consisting of gypsum, cement, and steel that covered Lower Manhattan. Human remains were found in the Bankers Trust building, not full bodies but tiny chunks. And it took 99 days to put out all the fires at Ground Zero. Okay, I'm just going to hit the nanothermite thing real quick. That's been a popular theory that's been out there, you know, mainly put forth by Steve Jones. But we'll leave aside the fact that nanothermite is an explosive. It's only got a detonation velocity of 895 meters a second, which isn't powerful enough to destroy concrete or steel. But the question is, could thousands of tons of nanothermite have produced the iron-rich spheres found at Ground Zero? And I'm going to read a little bit of T. Mark Hightower's blog post from 2011. And Mark states, calculations can help define the magnitude of various theories. I am referencing a calculation that Niels Herit emailed to me and various others on July 26, 2011. He calculated that the amount of thermitic material that would have been necessary to account for the quantity of iron-rich spheres in the WTC dust, assuming, of course, that the iron reaction product of the thermite reaction was the source of the spheres. The range of thermitic material that he calculated was from 29,000 metric tons to 143,000 metric tons per twin tower, depending on the iron oxide concentration assumed in the thermitic material. These numbers are unrealistically high in terms of quantity of thermitic material that could have or would have been loaded into a twin tower by the perpetrators, but that's not what he wanted to get into right here. Mark wants to show that the huge quantity of iron spheres illustrate a alternative explanation is needed. An intermediate value from Herod's calculations referenced above was that conservatively 11,660 metric tons of iron-rich spheres were present in the dust generated from the destruction of one twin tower. And if we assume that the iron-rich spheres were mostly iron, with the iron source possibly being the structural steel rather than the thermitic material, the energy required to convert this much iron into a molten state can be calculated. Let's assume that the iron-rich spheres were required a prior molten state for their formation. Furthermore, if we express the energy in terms of the quantity of TNT equivalent based on its heat of the explosion, these units can give us something to relate to in terms of commonly associated with specifying the magnitude of nuclear explosions, or kilotons. So if the calculation is done just for the energy necessary to melt the iron, on the order of 1 kiloton of TNT is the energy equivalent required. If we also include the energy necessary to heat the iron from room temperature to its melting point, then on the order of 4 kilotons TNT equivalent would be required. Of course, there would be more kilotons in this to account for all the other destruction in addition to just producing the iron-rich spheres. So just the spheres alone point to a massive energy source needed. And then another point is the temperature of the pile. That's what they referred to, the remains of the Twin Towers was the pile. Temperatures at ground zero were 600 to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit or even higher for 6 months after 9/11. Firemen were fighting fires for 99 days. Everest data showed that the temperature in one spot was 1,341 degrees on 9/16/01. And these high temperatures could be attributed to neutron bombs that were detonated underground in order to destroy the foundations of the towers. Workers at Ground Zero experienced hellish working conditions, and Charlie Vitchers described some of it. The fires were very intense on the pile. The heat was very intense. We were so lucky we didn't lose anyone. They lost a lot of equipment, and there was cherry red pieces of steel sticking out of the ground. It was almost like being in a steel manufacturing plant. And every time a grappler grabbed a piece of steel and shook it out, it would just fan the fire like a fan in a fireplace. He said that eventually the Army Corps of Engineers supplied him with infrared aerial shots of where the heat was, and it looked like the blob. The fire was moving under the pile. One day it would be here, 1,400 degrees. The next day it would be 2,000. And then 5 days later it went register over 600 degrees. So really the best evidence I've found for what happened is the Department of Energy water samples and the U.S. Geological Survey dust samples. We'll get into those now. So the DOE water samples. Steve Jones tries to refute the tritium levels in the basement of World Trade Center 6. He states that observation of tritium, an important component of hydrogen bomb fuel at the World Trade Center site, is at the few nanocurry level only, and that's strong evidence against the mini-nuke theory. But Steve fails to account for the dilution of the tritium by 4 million gallons of water sprayed by the firefighters. And Steve doesn't offer any explanation for how the tritium got there. World Trade Center 6 had a huge crater blasted out of the middle of it, and cement was so hot in the basement that it was flowing like lava. And what is tritium? Tritium is a very rare hydrogen isotope containing one proton and two neutrons. It's radioactive with a half-life of 12.32 years. The main use of tritium is to boost the yield of nuclear weapons. And the tritium that's produced by a nuclear explosion is almost completely converted into tritiated water, which then mixes with environmental water, and that's exactly what we see in the basement of 6 World Trade.
Okay. Does tritium have any other uses besides amplifying nuclear yield?
Some of the we'll get into the questions just at the end here, but real quick, I'll just say
sorry.
That. Tritium is used for like exit signs, or it's even used for like night scope sights or watches to make your watch glow in the dark. Okay, we'll hit the USGS dust samples here. And if all you knew about 9/11 was all of the common fission products that show up in the chemistry table of the USGS dust samples, which are arsenic, rubidium, strontium, barium, yttrium, niobium, molybdenum, silver, cadmium, antimony, cesium, lanthanum, and cerium, you would be highly suspicious that 9/11 was a nuclear event. Let's just take an in-depth look here at four of these elements from USGS dust samples. We'll look at barium, strontium, copper, and zinc. And this is from Jeff Frager's work, and I've got a link to that. So barium and strontium, people might argue that strontium and barium could be found in building debris, and they would be correct. However, strontium and barium would never be found as debris constituents in a demolition in these quantities. The levels never fall below 400 parts per million for barium, and they never drop below 700 parts per million for strontium, and they reach over 3,000 parts per million for both of them at the WTC-0116 location at Broadway and John Streets. Barium and strontium are rare trace elements with limited industrial uses, and the enormous peak in barium and strontium concentration at WTC-0116 is readily apparent in the chart below that you guys can't see, but we'll try to get this out to you. The concentration of the two elements reaches 3,130 parts per million for strontium and 3,670 parts per million for barium, or over 0.3% of the weight of the dust. So those are not trace amounts. Those are highly dangerous and toxic amounts. Barium and strontium are also critical components of nuclear fission and the decay process. And what's really striking about the barium and strontium is the correlation between the concentrations of the two elements. It's extremely high. The coefficient of correlation between the concentration of barium and strontium at the indoor and the outdoor sampling locations is 0.99 to two decimal places, or 0.9897 if you take that out to four decimal places. So we have a correlation coefficient between the concentration of barium and the concentration of strontium at 0.9897, or near perfect. The maximum correlation coefficient that's possible is 1.0, and that would be a perfect match. But to obtain a correlation coefficient of 0.9897 with the number of measurements 14 around Lower Manhattan is very, very significant indeed. What this means is we can say there's a 99% correlation in the variation in the concentration between these two elements. They vary in lockstep. They vary together. When one element varies, so does the other. And we can state with absolute mathematical certainty that any change in the concentration of one element, either the barium or the strontium, is matched by the same change in the concentration of the other. Whatever process gave rise to the presence of either the barium or the strontium must have produced the other as well. And nuclear fission is the only process that explains that. And then another one is zinc. Not many people talk about zinc. But in the graph below that we'll get out to you, the zinc has been divided by a factor of 10 to avoid losing detail, and the high point for zinc was almost 3,000 parts per million. The variation in lead is matched by the variation in zinc almost perfectly across all sampling locations, including the indoor girder coating samples. And the concentration of copper follows that of zinc with one distinct exception at WTC-0115, which was at Trinity and Cortland Streets, just several hundred feet east of Building 4. So there seemed to be two copper-zinc relationships. If some of the zinc was being formed by beta decay of copper, then the high copper at the WTC-0115 location could reduce the zinc, since the formation of zinc by that decay pathway would be retarded by material being held up at the copper stage before decaying onto zinc. Therefore, the graph does confirm that some of the zinc was indeed being formed by beta decay of copper, which would be a small mercy for the new people of New York, as those isotopes from zinc are not radioactive. The copper found in the ground zero dust is indicative of nuclear fission. If we plot the concentration of copper against zinc and nickel, we obtain the graphs pictured here. The concentration of nickel was almost the same everywhere, except for the peak of 88 parts per million, matched by the peak of copper at 450 parts per million. The copper-zinc relationship is interesting, showing, in fact, two distinct relationships, again, depending on isotopic composition. There are two radioactive isotopes of copper, Cu64 and Cu67, with short half-lives of 12.7 hours and 2.58 days, respectively, which then decay into zinc isotopes. The other two isotopes, copper-60 and 61, decay the other way by positron emission into nickel, and in fact, Cu64 goes both ways into nickel and zinc. And this explains why there's two copper-zinc relationships. The decay of radioactive copper by beta particle emission into zinc would have been another source for the extraordinarily high concentration of zinc found in the Trade Center dust. And we look at zinc at the intersection of Water Street in New York. It's 2,990 parts per million, and that immediately stands out. Zinc is the most common trace element at all the sampling locations, generally between 1,000 and 2,000 parts per million, except for the spike of nearly 3,000 parts per million. So nearly in that one spot, almost 0.3% of the dust was zinc, and that exceeds the concentration of supposed non-trace elements.
Don, excuse me, let me cut you off here for a second.
Sure.
We're at over 15 minutes here, and my thought is that you probably have considerably more evidence to present.
Actually, I got about one more paragraph left, actually. I can wrap this up. Yeah, I cut it off after the zinc, so
okay.
we're going to get done here in about 2 minutes.
Because the other suggestion I was going to have was that we cut it off here, take questions and answers on this, and then you come back at another time and present the rest of your information.
Sure, I'll be happy to come. Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll just sum it up real quick here. So how did all this zinc get into the dust? So Jeff was talking about two normal processes that you see nuclear fission is producing the zinc, you know, from copper. And there's also another third lesser known process, which is called ternary fission. And ternary fission means instead of the uranium nucleus getting split into two, it gets split into three parts. So if it gets split into three equal parts, that's zinc. So this is it takes very high energy levels to produce ternary fission. And 9/11 was obviously a high energy event. So the dust in the water samples also tell us that we've got evidence for fission-triggered fusion bombs, and they seems to be neutron bombs. So yeah, I'll go ahead and take any questions that you guys have.
Okay, can we assume then that you'll come back
sure.
next time and conclude your presentation? And
sure. I'd be happy to come. Yeah, I'd be happy to come back. Yeah.
Great. Okay.
Will you be able to email that report to the people on the call?
You know what, I can get it to Craig, and then he can get it out. And all of this stuff is on Veterans Today, but I got a link for
right.
it.
He can attach it to the minutes.
Yeah, I'll send this to Craig, and then he can get it out to you guys. Yeah.
Okay, so given all that, just please confine your discussion questions for the time being to what has been presented today, with the understanding that next time Don is back, we will be more open-ended about this, okay? Since we have a very limited amount of time to work with tonight, we have other guests we need to hear from. So besides me, who would like to be on the stack to ask?
I would. James Hufford.
James, okay. Who else?
Elizabeth.
Wayne. Elizabeth, who else?
Wayne,
who else?
I just got cut off and came back on.
Who's this?
Mark.
Mark. Okay. Okay, Mark. So I just ask, does anybody have a question or a comment? We'd like to be, have their name on the stack to ask a question
like
or comment.
I'd like to ask a question.
Okay, Mark. And who else? Okay, I'll put myself last. Okay, James, you're first.
Okay, well,
keep it short, okay, because we're running a limited time. Go ahead.
Okay, this is going to be a challenge because I have about 5 questions, and I don't know whether I'm going to get through them all. But first of all, could you just summarize what Stephen Jones or Neil Zaharet's response to your evidence is?
Well, when it comes to the USGS dust samples, there is no response. We've tried to contact Steve several times. He just won't comment on it.
Okay.
He's busy. I work with him. It's hard to get him.
Okay. Then the related question, what would you say about the presence, I think confirmed presence, of the thermite and nanothermite in the dust samples? How does that conform with what you were talking about?
Okay, as I addressed earlier, what we saw was mainly what they're making their claims on is the iron-rich spheres, but
they've identified the chips of nanothermite.
Well, nanothermite doesn't exist. Let's start there. I was talking to Gordon Duff, and his guys were on the project at Los Alamos Lab that created the nanothermite. And the only nanothermite they could produce, you know, on Earth here at Los Alamos was a 10-micron product. And the scientists there said that couldn't blow a hole in a piece of paper. They did, on the International Space Station, they were able to produce some 6-micron nanothermite, and that was explosive, but they were only able to produce 2 grams of it.
Okay, so you're saying that those... I'm summarizing here, but you'd say to say that those guys were all wet in their conclusions. Okay. Do your findings say anything at all about who might have set up or performed the operation?
Well, the dust samples and the water samples aren't going to tell you who did it, but you know, I've got my own thoughts on that. And, as far as I can tell, it was Israel that was behind it.
Yeah, I know everybody has that suspicion, but nobody has the proof.
Well,
I mean, I have that suspicion too, but still nobody has.
The only people arrested on 9/11 were Israelis.
Well, that's true. Israelis had foreknowledge, so they must have done it. Well, a lot of other people had foreknowledge, so they must have done it too, I guess.
Okay, anything else, James? Make it quick, please, because other people want to go through.
Okay, let's see. What would you say about the health effects, for instance, are there health effects being registered among first responders and other people that were nearby?
Yep,
traced?
Well, okay, people got cancers, and the cancers we're seeing are consistent with what you would see with the nuclear event. But, you know, again, I'm not a doctor or an oncologist, so take that with a grain of salt. But as of March of 2011, 1,003 first responders were dead of cancer. And I've got YouTube videos showing, they're out there on YouTube, where when the Ground Zero workers were leaving Ground Zero before they could actually get out of the area, two guys in full hazmat suits would scrub their boots and their pants, you know, right down to get rid of the nuclear contamination. All the trucks that left Ground Zero were sprayed, decontaminated before they were allowed to leave.
Yeah, I see. But you seem to leave the window open for terrorists having gotten in and planted many nukes ahead of time.
Well, it was. I think it was Mossad.
Well, you think it was, but I mean, okay. What you've given us seems to leave that door open.
Okay, James, we're really short on time, so let's give everybody else a chance here, and then we'll have another opportunity with Don in the future. Okay, we'll be hopefully more time.
Okay,
Elizabeth, thank you. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Don, it's interesting. I think you gave a very clear and articulate summary, And so I'm wondering if it would pass peer review, you know, if it was submitted to a journal somewhere. And I'm also wondering what your own credentials are, your background, education, and so on.
Okay, yeah, I'm not a scientist, so yeah, I did email Craig. It's not like Craig was having a computer issue there, but I've got a, I'm an IT guy. I've got a Bachelor of Science in Information Technology degree, mm-hmm. and I taught myself nuclear physics here over the last couple of years.
Okay, and now when you say, I wrote a book about nuclear disarmament in 1987, and I had to understand what fission and fusion were. So fusion bombs, I don't really know what they are. Like, I don't remember that I did.
Oh, okay. That's okay. Fusion is when
I know what it is. It's the suns. Yep. But fusion bombs, that's my question.
Yeah, fusion, it's sort of the same concept. But yeah, it's hydrogen. It's a hydrogen bomb or an H bomb. You have to normally those isotopes of hydrogen will repel each other unless you can create enough heat and break the Coulomb barrier, and then you can get the two elements to fuse together, and then in the once they fuse, there's a loss of mass, and according to the Einstein equation, you'll then get energy out of that.
Okay, that's all. I don't want to take any more time. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Wayne, you next.
Oh, yes, so thank you very much. My question is related to the audio, the auditory record. You know, when people hypothesize many nukes, it seems that the because a nuclear explosion is an instantaneous release of energy, that's how it has to be, that it would be a big, shall we say, big bang, right? And, for example, in the NIST NCSAR report, they said 1 kilogram of RDX would have made a sound that would be 130 dBs at a distance of a kilometer. I mean, that's what they say. So a known tactical nuclear weapon, like the W-54 nuclear artillery shells that people have talked about, could have a yield as low as 10 tons of TNT, 10,000 kilograms, and that would give a blast 2,500 times louder than what NIST said would have been clearly documented. You know, are we talking nuclear weapon, nuclear shells that are far, far, far smaller than 10 tons of TNT, or what?
Well, okay, the first point to make there is that chemical and
nuclear... Could you please address the sound levels? Okay.
Yeah, let me hit the noise levels first. Actually, nukes, when they explode, make more of a rumble. They don't have the crackle pop of a chemical explosive. So it's a whole different mechanism of destroying things.
Crackle
pop. The chemical explosives like TNT, you know, you hear a big bang. With nukes, you get kind of a rumble. And if you watch clips of the towers coming down, you'll hear that rumble.
Okay. Thanks. Mark?
Yeah, that was a really great presentation. I'm not a physicist, but I was really impressed. Do you have any ideas or thoughts about how many devices were in the building, nuclear devices?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we go around and around on that. My inbox is full of those type of questions. You know, it's been speculated that, hey, these were really... above ground in the towers, there's obviously nuclear bombs going off, and by definition, any nuclear explosion above ground had to be small, or else it would have been a dead giveaway. So, my thought is there has to be probably more smaller devices. You know, underground, obviously, there were some big ones. We've got, if you guys bring me back, I'll talk about the pothole at Ground Zero and all this other stuff. But above ground, they had to be very small bombs. So maybe 5 to 10 per tower. You know, it's hard to tell just by looking at it, because once the destruction sequence starts, the whole building just turns into dust. It's hard to see exactly what's going on.
You don't think there could have been a combination of any kind of thermite and nuclear devices?
Well, my own thought would be on the outside of the building they had regular explosives like RDX, and on the nukes were for the core columns of the Twin Towers, And there was also three mini nukes in the basement of Building 7, and at least one mini nuke in the basement of Building 6.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm assuming, John, that you're, from what we were talking about earlier, that you'll come back next month and continue this, and we'll give you a lot more time.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
No, not a problem.
So, my personal question has to do with something you said earlier in the presentation. You referred to recent releases by Russian intelligence. Now, I saw mention of that in Gordon Duff's thing, and so I tried to research that, and I found it all over the Internet, but everything pointed right back to his article. And he doesn't get any documentation, so I'd like to know where this Russian intelligence source is.
Gordon got a data dump. Apparently somebody, the articles he writes, he's not, you know, writing it himself. He got a data dump, and he's got sources that I don't have. So I guess you can take that with a grain of salt.
I take a lot of what Gordon Duff says with a grain of salt personally.
Gordon's been good to me. He lets me write whatever I want. They don't censor me.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. So you don't have any other reference to that claim about Russian intelligence, right?
I think with, you know, these sort of things, they kind of leak out over time. So I would just say stay tuned.
Are you in a position to ask Gordon for some more corroborating evidence about this Russian intelligence leak, just to show that it actually did come from Russian intelligence, or no?
Gordon emailed me about 14 times today, and I haven't gotten through all of them. Yeah, but
I'd appreciate that. Maybe if you do it before next time and see what he has to say about the.
I will bring that up.
Okay, thank you. All right, so that brings us to the close of our list for now, and we're also out of time for this subject, but Don had promised to come back next week, continue the presentation, conclude it hopefully, and we will definitely make sure there's plenty of more time for open-ended questioning so we can get into some of the hairier details that I'm sure others would like to pursue with him. Okay? Thank you so much, Don, for a very well-done presentation. And cogent, maybe not persuasive for everybody, but certainly provoking and enough to interest people to pursue it with you next time. Thank you.
Thanks,
Ken, could I make a suggestion?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to suggest that we at least invite Stephen Jones on the call.
Okay. Would you care to pursue that and see if he's willing?
I've got his email address. I don't know if he'd respond to me or not, but I could try.
Well, it would be even better maybe to invite Neil Tarrant.
That would be fun. Oh, good. Well,
he's on the panel, and he's a very good friend, and I'm sure he would. Come on.
Would you take care of that, Elizabeth?
If somebody emails me and asks me to do it, I will. Neil's nanochemistry professor. You know, that was his whole field for 40 years. He published, you know, 75 articles. He knows nanochemistry.
Yeah, I think
more than anybody else.
I just think we need an offset to this.
Yeah, we do, but I think Neil's would be better.
Okay, I'll concur with that.
Okay.
All right. So I'll email you that in your request, Elizabeth, for a moment.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. All right. So let's move on next to our feature presentation for this today is The Anatomy of a Great Deception. There's a new film that everybody's talking about and many people pinning their hopes on by filmmaker David Hooper, who's with us, and Wayne Tusty, who was one of the people that pursued him along with Ned Blaney. We'll give a brief intro. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, so thank you very much. I don't have a lot to say. I think David is going to speak mostly about the film. I just want to mention that I was first introduced to David on some of our conference calls, and it was really interesting to hear about the efforts that he had made to develop a film that talked about his journey from being a unaware to going down the rabbit hole, so to speak, into the issues related to what happened to the Twin Towers. It was, some of the things that were most remarkable were the fact that he put these together. He presented them to friends in the theater so that they could see it and then could get reactions from it to see how the film would proceed. I've seen most of it at one time, an earlier version, and I've been really helpful in trying to spread the word. At least I hope I've been helpful.
You have, very much.
So I think I don't know what else I can say except stay tuned for September, because we're going to be having a really interesting movie out there, and I'm looking forward to it. So Dave, I think I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, one more before you go, Dave. Don, you're still on the call, right, Don Fox?
Yeah, I'm still here. Yep.
Don, I'm sorry. I should check with you before we pursue the Neil Sarah thing, because we need to know that that's okay with you too. You don't mind having him on the call?
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay. Sorry for the interruption. Okay, Dave, go ahead.
Hey, everybody. My name's Dave Hooper. I don't have a presentation planned out like some of the good ones I heard before. Wayne got it right. I was just a regular guy a few years ago, and this is sort of the synopsis of the film. Just a regular American businessman with a family who had certainly heard at parties or around that there was some controversies with 9/11. I really rolled my eyes about it. Started researching one question in early 2011, and it began a domino effect. And I had this problem where I knew 9/11, the official story, just was impossible. And I was trying to discuss this with my friends and my family, my wife, my mom, my sister, and they just had such a hard time accepting it. And it's really interesting now to listen to some of you, because the very same scientific evidence I was trying to show them, I would bring them into my office, I'd show them one or two bits, but it just wouldn't put the entire picture together, and that's when I decided to make my story. And to make a really long story short, there have been other 9/11 films. This is, in a sense, there's two things that are different about this one. But it's not like there's evidence or material in there that people inside the 9/11 truth community haven't seen. I think pretty much every clip is familiar in some way. This film is really targeted to the sleeping masses, let's call them. People like me 3.5 years ago who were a strong 99-minute argument away from having their eyes open, but like so many people, unable to receive the story in an order that makes sense. And that's why I put the film together. I frankly thought I was going to be done with it after I showed it to my wife and a few friends. They started telling some people, and that led to a 100-plus person, a screening for 100 people. Before the event happened, I took an informal poll. How many of you guys know how many of you believe the official story of 9/11? And almost the entire room raised their hand. Roughly 80% of the audience had no idea that there were any controversies. And so it was a big test to see how this was going to show to them. And it tested off the charts. I've had people circling back to me because they are awake now. They are doing their own research, and this includes lawyers, police officers, local politicians, my personal friends, people mostly in the Detroit area for this first screening. So we decided to do something with the film. Here are the pertinent parts. I think that here's what I think is important about the film, and then I'll mention one way I think that this community could help the film and how the film could help the community, and then I'm going to sit back, and if anyone has any questions, we can do that. So the first part of this film is a personal story. There are about 50 or so 9/11 movies that I could identify, And I've always felt that most of them were done by someone that's almost angry, angry at the audience for not being aware of this as well. And I feel that. I felt that myself for a while. This is a very gentle indoctrination into the realities of 9/11. It's based completely in science and research, but there are my personal feelings and thoughts mixed in with it. And it seems that that's what has a connection with people. So on that level, I think the film has passed the mustard test to date, that it connects with people whether they're in the movement or not. And that's what the film is meant to do. It's meant to bridge that gap between us. So many of us have a spouse or someone close to us in our lives where we can't even talk about this subject. This film is meant to open up that conversation. So the second part of the film that makes it unique is the way we're going to distribute it. And this is this one's more up my background. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. I've had 6 companies. They've done cumulatively about $100 million in my lifetime. I've gone out of business a few times. I've sold a couple. I've been humbled. But the last business was a film distribution company. We sold DVDs and CDs and books and things like that over the internet. We actually were one of the largest in the nation at the time, shipping about 120,000 movies a month. That's what we were selling. So we dusted off our old distribution network for this film. And bottom line is we're going to go around conventional gatekeepers. These are the same companies that I used to do business with all the time. I understand their mechanisms and what they do, sometimes not on purpose, but what they do that keeps thought-provoking films, media stories out of the mainstream population's minds. And we're going to cut them off. So our plan is to, we're going to test this out in the city of Detroit in September. The film is opening September 5th. The entire 9/11 community is invited to Detroit. There are some nice parts of Detroit, so don't be scared. But we're going to have a launch party. There should be 1,000 or 2,000 people there. We're going to have a few presentations from maybe Richard Gage or even some people that are on this call. And our plan is to make this movie known in at least the city of Detroit, so that you cannot go home in the month of August or September without knowing about it. The meat and potatoes of the plan, there's many aspects of it. I won't have the time to talk about it now. The meat and potatoes of the plan is we're going to get the film, which is going to be packaged in a very sleek, elegant, curiosity-inducing, mysterious sort of packaging. It's going to be at the checkout counter of thousands of retail locations just in the city of Detroit, with displays promoting the film, promoting its theater schedule, promoting other aspects that even if someone doesn't purchase the film will still be exposed to some issues of 9/11. So the plan involves us putting promotional material in thousands of stores a month before the opening, which will be visited by about 2.1 million unique citizens of the Detroit metro area. And from that, we're hoping to sell about 100. Our goal is to sell 100,000 units of the movie in the city of Detroit. If that works, or we get anywhere close to that, we will release this film on a city-by-city basis across the country using this method. And we will essentially be able to pay for ourselves as a byproduct of selling the movie. We will be able to fund ourselves and actually provide some pledges to a few nonprofits that were significant, at least to me, in opening up my eyes. So that's where we are. This film is meant to get into the public domain. It is not really geared for the 9/11 community. There's nothing new in there for the 9/11 community. This is what is different is that this is geared for the general population with a plan to get the movie in the hands of the general population under the guise of an impulse purchase item at the cash register. of retail locations in the city of Detroit. We will also be doing the same concept with online stores, very much like my old business that used to sell movies and books. And what would happen is we'd get 4,000 people a day going through our checkout, and whatever item we wanted to put in our checkout as an add-on purchase item, we would be able to move that item significantly. So we right now have, we've got about 20 people on the street, and we've got a few people that are contacting some of the big suppliers in this world to do just that. Get us, whether it's online or offline, get that movie right near the checkout of any retail location, web or street. And we are right now, and so but now we get to the part where this film can help the community and what the community can do for the film. I am not a scientist. I'm a storyteller. And this movie does nothing more than aggregate the wonderful scientific work that's been done, and it wraps it up in a package that just a regular John Doe can see, understand, and be moved by. So it's something, this film is in conjunction with the 9/11 community. And its goal is to bring a lot of attention, a lot of new memberships, a lot of new subscribers, a lot of new readers. It's already happening in my hometown. People are coming to me with articles written by the types of people that are on these calls. So I was very encouraged by that. Where the community can help the film, and this is where I'll leave off, I have financed everything myself to date. I went without a job for 3 years while I researched this and studied it, went through all of my savings. I've gone as far as I can go, as my wife. We started a crowdfunding campaign, which is now the crowdfunding campaign is targeted to the 9/11 community, because it will be the 9/11 community that once again has to do the work to wake people up. We've raised about $24,000 from the crowd. We're shooting for $50,000. We've got about 20-some days left on our campaign. The level of success of this campaign will determine the amount of marketing that is put into the film. So I want to have as good and ample a test as possible. And if this works, this could really change the whole conversation in this country, because we'll begin to do this city by city, and we'll do it until someone stops us or speeds us up. If it works in Detroit, going out and raising a few million dollars to put this movie out everywhere would not be so difficult. But we've got to get Detroit to work. In order for Detroit to work, we need to have a very successful crowdfunding campaign. And if there's any, the group on this call could do to help promote that campaign, which will indirectly through a few more stages of work, bring a spotlight onto the scientific work that's being done, this could really be a situation where the film and the truth community are, one hand is helping the other while the other one is, you understand. So that's the concept of the film. I'll stop talking and see if anyone has any questions. I'll be happy to do my best to answer them.
Thank you, James.
James, I have a question.
All right, James, who else would like to be on the stack?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, who else?
Luke.
Luke, who else? Okay, I'll put myself nice. Go ahead, James.
I'd like to. Okay, I have a guaranteed annual venue at a movie theater that my group rents in Des Moines, Iowa every September 11th. And I could show this film if we can get it early enough to do it. Any chance we can get it a couple of weeks before 9/11?
Yes. The film will be a DVD form probably a week or two into the month of August, maybe the third week of August. It'll hit shelves on the 5th of September. I can get you a copy early. If you're going to play it at a theater or something like that, why don't you send me an email?
Okay.
Someone over there has my contact information.
Okay. Does somebody have the contact information for him?
Yeah, I do. Craig McKee, I have it, yeah.
Could you send it to me, Craig?
let's put it in the minutes, okay, so everybody
sure.
can
contact. Okay, sure, great. Oh, I'll get it. I'll request it. Thank you.
Yeah, let's have a play at your theater. I think that'd be great.
Yeah, we do. Every 9/11, we show something, and that's what we wanted to show this year, if we could get it in time.
Yeah, the film just got invited to actually a 9/11 film festival in Oakland that Ken Jenkins runs. So
sure.
We'll probably be in San Francisco or Oakland on that day, but we could probably get a couple of people to come out or at least get you the film so you can play it.
Yeah, you bet.
Great. Thank you, Vince. Elizabeth?
Dave, I tweet for the consensus panel every day for several hours. And well, not several, sometimes maybe half an hour, sometimes maybe several. And I've been doing that for about a year, and I've worked it up to 2,400 followers, which is not easy to do. But one thing you can do is you can tweet. Some of the followers have themselves got 200,000 or 300,000. Some have 600,000 followers. And if I tweet a direct message, a direct tweet to them, then it comes into their sort of tweet in basket instead of just flowing through like the millions of other tweets that are in the line. So everybody looks at their tweet in basket to see who's tweeted to them directly. So what I could do for you is tweet from the consensus panel to these accounts that you'd never imagine had 200,000 followers and who are following the consensus panel. And so then if they retweet it because they see it, then their 200,000 followers, a percentage of those will see it go by in the scroll of tweets that everybody gets. And I figure that's maybe 5%. Like, you know, like nobody looks at all their tweets that come through. So I was just thinking I could do that if you wanted to give me little news items about your DVD whenever they come out.
Well, that idea makes my mouth water, Elizabeth. And if you pull that off, I'm taking you out to dinner and probably throwing in some flowers as well. So,
okay.
So I will.
You've got to come out here to do it, though.
All right, don't worry. That will the ball will be on my court on that one. So
okay.
I will get a hold of you. I'm going to be in Chicago the rest of this week. I'm going to the AIA convention with some folks from Architects and Engineers.
Sure.
But if you can give me till the beginning of next week, either I or I'll have someone from my staff get a hold of you to compose what that tweet might be, and we will hold you in high esteem for a very long time.
Well, I'll do what I can.
Yeah. Very much appreciated. And I will get back to you on that one. And thank
you. You're welcome. And good for you. The marketing idea, this is the thing that's been missing, is the marketing to the general public. That's such to do that now. And I think the public now, that 13 years have gone by, I've noticed the mainstream media is not resisting everything that Richard is doing, with his Rethink campaign. The media is just covering it like, oh, it's a bumblebee that came along. We'll just look at it. We won't have yay or nay. It's just, you know, another piece of news. There's no resistance right now. So
Something going on. The venues and the people, you know, I've started several businesses before, and I'm very well familiar with the type of resistance you get when you begin.
Yeah.
I was actually expecting more resistance than would be usual in a regular startup because the idea of the business or the film is controversial and hard to accept. What I've actually ended up finding out, there are so many closet truthers in this world.
Doors
are opening up for us. We are getting the nicest theaters in Detroit. The most powerful radio stations, we cut deals with them. We have a lot of fans. I really think this country is poised for something to just, that's going to be some catalyst that's going to finally just
throw
this thing into the spotlight.
I agree.
And
I think
it was your 9/11 consensus panel article that came out, I think it was June 2nd.
Yeah,
we've probably ourselves tweeted that article out to thousands of people, and I thought the timing of that was beautiful. It was right in conjunction with some events happening with the film, and there's some momentum happening here that I'd like us to capitalize on. And so on that note, if anyone else has a similar scenario as Elizabeth, where you would be inclined to promote the film or at least discuss it on your social media, please get a hold. I will do anything to help make that happen.
You know, the other thing you can do, Dave, is you can go to CNN Facebook page or MSNBC or Democracy Today, any of these big Facebook pages, and wait until they discuss something like on a Sunday or in the evening where there's low, there's not a lot
monitoring.
Of
monitoring.
Yeah, there's not a lot of comments going on, and you can see the last comment was maybe 3 hours ago. So then you plug in the information about your film, and it sits there like for the next 8 hours on the CNN.
Ooh, great idea.
Near the top. I do that, and you know, Facebook knows I'm doing it. And every time I do it, they bring up one of those little captcha things, and they make it so hard for me to read. It's so congested that then you click on the audio, and that's all burbled and garbled. Like they are fighting you right there, right there. But anyway, that's another, because then I can look at the consensus panels. We've got our web stats that, you know, you can go into AW stats. You can see exactly who is looking at your web page, and you can see that these Facebook pages are drawing in a lot of people. So that's another thought.
No, that's a good idea, and that actually goes to one of the important elements of this distribution plan, because there's a common theme you'll hear, which is crowd-funded and crowd-distributed. That's what we've done with our street team folks in Detroit. If you go to our funding campaign, which is on a website called Indiegogo. It's Indiegogo.com. And if you just look up The Anatomy of a Great Deception, our film will come up. In fact, we're on the first page of film results for the entire site for the Globe. And, you know, there are thousands of films in Indiegogo, and we are in the top six right now, which I was surprised to have. And one of the pieces of the plan is we've set up a bunch of what's called perks, because you can't take equity investors in a film through Indiegogo, at least not without some restrictions. And we are now beginning a phase of this film where if you go on and look at the perks, you'll see that there's two themes. One is be involved in the making of the film and get your name on screen, and there's some other fun stuff like that. The other theme of the perks is buy a pack of movies at a big discount, whether it's two, three. We have packages as many as 500 DVDs, and part of our plan is to turn the 9/11 Truth community into a big spoke of our distribution plan. If we can get a few thousand truthers to each purchase 5, 10, 20 DVDs, and then they distribute those to their friends, or sell them at flea markets, or get them up for sale in their local coffee shop, or do whatever it is they want to do with them, we could have the most widely distributed film in history. So that just began yesterday, and that's pretty exciting. We haven't put any press releases out about it, but there's an incredible amount of momentum happening for this film and the community right now, which, you know, I'd like to see us capitalize on, because we don't get a lot of opportunities like this, and you know, it's only every few years where something big happens or there's a big speaking tour or something like that. But those are my 2 cents about that.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth. Luke, you're next.
I'm sorry, did you say something
Luke?
To me, or was there another question time?
Yeah, there's two more people on the set. Luke, was it Luke or
who's next? Maybe,
I'm sorry, who?
Who, Mook?
Yeah, you're next.
Speaking. Hi, Dave. Great work.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. I love your idea about the closet 9/11 truthers. They're all over the place. I do public access, and I want to get a public access version of this, and I'd like to coincide it with your September 11th release. So I'll be getting in touch with you once I get the memo about this. I'll get your contact information and give you an email.
All right.
I can't hear anything. Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. All right. So have you considered a public access version? As far as I can tell, that's the only airwaves we got left.
Public access version, yes. I'm not overly excited about any existing media. I'm not going to ever turn my back on them, but we're going into this with the attitude we're going to have to get this distributed ourselves. So if there's any media, certainly public access.
I have hundreds of stations around the country. That some of them have series, some of them just do one-offs. And as far as I can see, that's the only TV. The commercial isn't going to show this. But anyway, I'm going to send you an email once I find out what your email is, and we can discuss it further in that light.
Okay. I'll be looking for it. I'm excited for that one.
All right. Because it's just another avenue, another vector to get the mosquito bite out there.
Exactly. All right, Luke, I like it.
Cool.
Anyway, nice work. I love your marketing plan, and I think that drawing the 9/11 Truth community into your plan is the way to go.
I hope so. We'll find out.
Yep. Good work.
Okay.
Thanks. I'm going to mute out now. *6.
*6, all right. Thank you. Okay, this is Ken. I have two quick questions for you. The first is there any financial transparency system regarding your operation?
There is, but nothing that you would see yet. We're just overwhelmed with everything that we're being asked to put out there. I'd be happy to share our business plan or the financials with anyone. I've been wrestling with how to get that onto our website and our Indiegogo campaign. I'm happy to share even down to the details of where the money's going.
I'll send you a suggestion borrowed from another campaign, and you can take it or leave it.
Okay.
The other question has to do with my understanding of your marketing plan is that you're going to be selling the DVDs at the same time that you're promoting a theater schedule. Is that correct?
You said I'm going to be selling the DVD as I'm promoting a theater schedule?
Yeah, that's what I understood you to say, that in the convenience stores and so forth, that there would be promotions of a theater schedule at the same time that you were marketing the DVDs. Is that right? You don't see one as undermining the other in any kind of way, huh?
You broke up again a little bit for the last sentence.
Yeah.
Repeat that?
You don't see the two as conflicting in any way, then?
Well, there will be some cannibalization of sales by going that route. That method is a relatively new method in Hollywood. It's what's called a day-and-date release, and that's where you come out with theater and DVD at the same time. And
really?
The idea spawned from a few years back. Companies were just doing the math because they'd spend $40 million to put a film out, and then they'd spend another $10 million to promote the DVD. And so they started doing some tests where they launched both of them at the same time, and they pare down the marketing budget from $50 million down to $40 million. And it really, there was a drop-off in sales, but nowhere nearly enough for it to make the plan for. So from my perspective, that will help the film, because theaters require that you fill that theater. And most of them require big full-page ads or half-page ads in the local major newspaper. However, if we can show them that, hey, we're going to 2 million people are going to see the ads for your theater. Don't worry about it being filled. They've been a lot more willing to talk to us and set up run schedules. So we'll end up being in probably 3 or 4 art houses in Detroit. If we ran from September 5th through September 11th or 12th, I'd be very happy.
Hello?
I am here.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I just lost my earphone there for a second. Okay, does anybody else have a burning question for Dave, or can we thank him and move on to the next issue?
It's Craig. I just wanted to clarify for the purposes of the minutes. Was I to understand that I'm supposed to put Dave's like contact information in the minutes, and is he okay with that, or did I get
that
wrong?
That was my understanding. Dave, is that suitable with you?
Yeah, I mean, this just goes to people on the call, or is this like going out to a million people somewhere?
No, it goes out to about 125 activists, some of whom are on the call, but most of whom are not. But it's only going out to, it goes out to activists.
I might regret this later, but yeah, just go ahead and put that on the minutes, and one way or another, we'll get the call sorted out by someone in the company if it's not me directly. But
why don't you just give it to the people on the call?
Yeah.
All right.
It.
All right. Yeah. So it's really easy. It's D Hooper, D H O O P E R. D Hooper at Moving Flix, and it's Flix CKS, MOVINGFLICKS.com. D Hooper at MovingFlix.com, and if anyone needs to call me or text me, my cell is 312-933-2697.
What's the first 269? What's the first the prefix to that, David?
312.
312-933-2697. Got it.
Okay. Dave, we want to give you our bottom line thanks for coming on tonight and giving us this timely information about a film that a lot of people in the 9/11 Truth community are pinning their hopes on as the thing that's going to move us to the next stage of public awareness. So best of luck, and I hope we can hear updates from you from time to time as to how things are going, and hopefully some people will be in touch with you about how they can help promote the film.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Thank you, Wayne, for getting me on here. And all of you guys, thanks for everything you've done. I am literally a result of all of your work. So it's working. It's paying off. Just maybe not as fast as we'd like, but we are moving towards this goal, and I don't see what can stop it. So thank you, guys. I'm going to wait to hear from some of you, but I got to peel off right now because I've got like four other phone calls to make.
Sure enough. Thanks again, man.
All right, guys. Take care. And Cheryl, we
got to
talk soon, too. All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, yep.
All right, bye.
All right, our last major subject tonight is the Truth on the C-SPAN campaign, which Andy Steele is the organizer for. Cheryl, you can give us a really brief intro for Andy, and then well, he can take it from there, okay?
Okay, great. With pleasure. So I had the pleasure of meeting Andy in New York just a couple weeks ago at the 9/11 Museum opening. And Andy has had this creative idea of having a call-in to C-SPAN on their morning call-in program, and where there's usually senators or congressmen or media people there. And he has people call in. He gives the people the question, and he guides them through it. And you call in, and you get on, and put the people on the spot, the congressman or whatever. And I think the focus was usually Building 7. And then Andy made videos of all the responses of the congresspeople, et cetera, and you can see that on, I think, YouTube. And so he was well organized, and it had really guided the people through the calls. And he had to organize and get a lot of different people to make the calls, because once C-SPAN got our phone numbers, they blocked us after that. So. And I think Andy also does a weekly radio show online called 9/11 Free Fall. So I guess that does it, Andy.
Hi. Thanks. Thanks for having me on this call. I didn't even know this existed. So I'll try to be brief and just describe how the campaign went. I've been kind of quiet about my own involvement or how it was being organized up until now. Basically, C-SPAN knows who I am now. And there might be some things in terms of operational security that I may have to sound kind of mysterious on at this point, so I'm not doing it to sound mysterious and all cool and everything. It's just at this point because things are going on right now. So at some point, though, I'll be able to talk about some of the stuff more openly, and it'll make sense why I'm being kind of quiet about some aspects of it. But essentially, the way it's worked, the way it's got started is people have been calling into this program, Washington Journal, for years. It's on C-SPAN. And it's a program where you can call in and you can ask congressmen and other government officials, whoever comes on there, writers for major newspapers questions, usually about some kind of, you know, whatever topic. A lot of times national security is a big topic on there. So I would hear people call in and bring up 9/11, but they would also fill it in with all sorts of other stuff. And what would normally happen is either the host would distract the caller with some other question, or they would just pick out the simplest thing that they could address out of what he said and ignore everything about Building 7 and nanothermite and all, you know, free fall and all that stuff. So I thought, what if people just called in all the time and just asked a very focused question and didn't delineate from that? So I did it, because I never ask anyone to do anything I won't do myself. So I did it first with John McCain, and we actually caught John McCain in a lie. This is a somewhat, you know, minor news, somewhat big news, because he, when I called him and asked him about the 105 feet of free fall in Building 7, he claimed that he had no knowledge of the issue. That's a bald-faced lie. He allegedly wrote the foreword for the popular mechanics book Attacking Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Well, they didn't say AE 9/11 Truth in person, but anyone who talks about controlled demolition. He wrote the foreword for that, allegedly. And also an activist, Blair Gatsby, out of Arizona, had held a hunger strike outside his office and had correspondence with John McCain about this topic. And this was right before David Chandler publicly embarrassed NIST and got them to admit to Building 7's free fall. They had this correspondence, and McCain had said, well, if there's any new scientific information that comes up, you know, we can look at this again, something to that effect, kind of a brush-off statement. However, this was a few months before Chandler had gotten this to admit to the free fall. So now that opened us up, and this actually got us a meeting with McCain's office. I participated in it over the phone. So basically we realized that the C-SPAN thing is pretty cool. You put these people on the spot and they got to say something. They're on national television. Usually when you address congressmen or try to meet with them, these people are surrounded by a spongy membrane of polite emails and chit-chat that you never really, they're protected from you. You can't really get access to them. But here they are in front of 3 million people that C-SPAN claims is watching this program every morning. They got to say something. So the way the campaign worked is I would have to find somebody the night before, and I would give them the real question, write it out for them, make sure that they were happy with it, and also a fake question. Now, originally, you could just say, well, I have a question about national security, or I have a question about this and that, and then the screeners started asking you specifically what you wanted to talk about. Now, if anybody said that they wanted to talk about 9/11 Truth or ask about Building 7, even if they were talking about terrorism, national security, screeners would hang up on them. Even screeners would even say some nasty stuff to people, according to the reports that I got. They'd say, we're not going to be talking about 9/11 being an inside job today or ever. So what we had to do is just come up with total, just a fake question. And it would be something, you know, if they're talking about immigration, something about, what about this policy that this other congressman supports? So I'd have to come up with a Building 7 question and also a good enough fake question about the issue that they're talking about to get them on the air. So I ended up learning a lot about politics over this past year doing this and reading up on all these issues, and I could play it from both a Republican side and a Democrat side on every issue. So it's kind of, I'm pretty proud of myself from that. But that, essentially that's what it was. And then after a while they started, as Cheryl said, they started blocking people's phone numbers. I'm able to get on however or whenever I want because I have a phone where I can change the phone number on it. But I don't, you know, I can't expect people to do that themselves, so I always have to find a new person to do it. So we've been doing this. It went for over a year. We also had people who I had nothing to do with start calling in, copycatting, and I loved it, just randomly calling in and asking about Building 7. And then on Christmas, they asked, that Christmas morning, they asked, who's your political hero for 2013, and two people listed all the 9/11 callers calling in. So I'm very proud of that. There's also some very memorable calls that got through, like Sanger from the New York Times, that AE 9/11 Truth made a big deal out of because of what they said. And we actually had some congressmen give some very good answers, very, like Marcy Kaptur told us to keep pushing. Sanchez from California says, you know, I appreciate you making those calls, and we have to keep pushing. And then Jim McDermott out of Washington says that the questions are credible and deserve further investigation, the sooner the better, in his opinion. So we've had an effect. And C-SPAN doesn't like it. That's very obvious. And right now I've got a kind of a temporary armistice with them. That's all I'll say about that. But it's not like over yet, officially over. So if we're out, if we're getting this tape's getting sent out to 125 activists, what I need is manpower. Because then we may have to pick it up again depending on what happens with C-SPAN in the next couple of weeks. So we may need to pick this up, but even if we don't pick up this thing, there's other things like this that I want to do. And something that I really want to stress is that we need to be as organized as the people we're up against. The reason that the people we're up against are so successful is they plan everything to a T, and they follow protocol, and they don't delineate from plans. They're very driven, and they stay focused on what they need to do. That's as organized as we need to do, or as we need to be. So what I would like is for people to send me as much information about themselves as they feel comfortable with. I'm not talking about personal information like, who's in your family or anything like that. I'm talking about your emails, phone numbers if you feel comfortable, your name, and people get suspicious when people ask for that kind of stuff. I'm not some kind of agent or anything like that. I just simply want it so that if something is going on, let's say Dick Cheney is talking in Peoria, Illinois, selling a book or something, and I'd like somebody to confront them, I can say, okay, this person is a 9/11 truther in Peoria or whatever town is next to Peoria, and call him up and say, hey, could you go in there and ask him this question during the Q&A session and help you out with that and guide you through that, kind of be like this good guy octopus here to really give these guys help throughout the country. That's why I want the information. So send me as much as you feel comfortable with. I will give my phone number as a show of trust here or as an act of goodwill. My number is 315-335-9644. You can call me and just let me know you're a truther and want to help out. And my email address is asteele at ae911truth.org. And really, I just need manpower.
Would you like that information to be in the minutes for the other activists that might receive the minutes?
Right. Yeah, I want them to have that info, and then they can take it to their groups. Like I said, I personally look at it, I look at it as a war because I really want to get to a point where this is over and done with, and we've won, and I think it can happen because it's so obvious. But we have to be organized. We have to kind of fall into rank in some issue or some cases and some actions, like an army. And just like any kind of army fighting a war, you need people to send to the front lines. So I need as many people to know as many people as possible so that I can do these kind of things. I can see if somebody's speaking a particular talk show or if they're going to be speaking in public and somebody has the guts to go out and confront them in public. I can look and see who's on that list near there and who could theoretically do it, and then I could help and coach them through the whole process and walk them through it.
Okay, so you want to build a volunteer database, and you'd like people to respond to your contact information. What's their contact information if they'd like to help, right?
Right, and if anybody's nervous about it, they can give me a call and talk to me. I think I can assure anybody that I'm a genuine person. I've gotten a lot of people to call C-SPAN, and because they're usually pretty comfortable with me and know exactly where I'm coming from. So that's it. I really have nothing else to say about it right now. I may have more to talk about. And with regard to the whole C-SPAN thing, I feel like I could make my own movie about it. It's been a very interesting year. It's been very tiring, but there's been things, many fun victims. It's been kind of fun to an extent because I work as doing maintenance at a museum, and I've been cleaning toilets and fixing things and everything while at the same time coordinating people on the phone to call in to senators. if they knew that, if these senators can know that the guy in there is on his hands and knees, scrubbing the floor or something while they're on television doing this. I think it'd make a good movie, I think it'd be an entertaining movie. So I'll tell more about this someday when it's all over.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say for now. So I'll answer any questions.
All right, thanks, Andy. Does anybody have a question or comment for Andy?
Yeah, the phone number again, the last four digits was 96. Was it 94 or 44? I can't read my writing.
9644.
Okay, thanks.
Anybody with a question or a comment about to Andy about this operation?
This is James. I'd just like to tell Andy that we enjoyed watching the footage that was on YouTube at our monthly meeting of my group a couple months ago. So thank you.
Yeah, oh, no problem. And there'll be another video coming out too. I haven't gotten to it yet, but I'll explain why I haven't gotten to put it out later.
Well, look for that.
Yeah, Wayne here.
Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah, so Andy, are you searching for a cameo appearance in Dave's Anatomy of a Great Deception? It just might work.
Well, I mean, it might be interesting. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make things about me because it's really not. It's about all these other people. But you know, if Dave wants me to talk in it, I would, about what was done on C-SPAN. I think that the actual fact that all these people have called in and made these congressmen look so foolish should be highlighted somewhere.
Right. That's a great thought. May not be time for it, but I can just see it now. So. Okay, great. Thanks for everything you do. Over.
Okay, anybody else with a question or comment for Dave? Or for Andy and me?
Can I get your full phone number again, Andy?
Sure. It's 315-335-9644. And I'm not really worried about people having it, because somebody actually published it on the internet for something that was going around about Call Andy. Deal if 9/11 free fall for this, so it don't matter. I'm sure that they know it. This phone number is actually blocked at C-SPAN. I can't get through with it anymore.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? All right. Well, thank you so much, Andy. We're all supportive of what you're doing. I think we've all been entertained by the YouTube videos, and keep up the good work and keep us informed, and we'll do what we can to let people know that you're seeking volunteers and hopefully help you build a database of people around the country to continue to work.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. We move now into announcements, and is Diana still on the call?
Yes, I'm still here. Hi.
Okay. Diana asked if she could go first. She's got a very important announcement about something upcoming that will be of interest to everyone. And then if anybody else has any, we can go from there. Go ahead, Diana.
Yeah, I'm organizing with DC 9/11 Truth and ANETA here in Washington, and we've gotten the press club. We're going to have an event on 9/11, and also on the day before 9/11, we're going to have a dinner at the Clinton Room in the press club also. So we're happy that we got that place. It was very prestigious, and hopefully we can get the press to pay attention to us. And we have Wayne Costa from the 9/11 Truth is going to be speaking, and we have Susan Lindauer and Barry Kitson, the anthrax specialist. And we have an invitation out to Wayne Matson, I believe, this year from him. So,
Diana, I got to hang out there. I interrupted. Is anybody else having trouble hearing Diana?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. I'm gonna go outside because maybe it's a bad connection. Okay.
Okay.
I'll start again. We're DC 9/11 Truth, and we're organizing an event at the Press Club in DC, which is we're very fortunate to have gotten that space. Thanks to one of the members who's very favorable to our agenda. We're going to have a dinner on the 10th and a conference on the 11th. And Wayne Costa from AE911 Truth is going to speak, Susan Lindauer and Gary Kiffin, and we have an invitation to Wayne Matson. We're waiting to hear from him. So anybody that wants to give suggestions or participate in any way can be welcome to contact me.
Okay. Do you want to give your contact info?
Diana Helene, DianaHelene @gmail.com. Phone number 202-640-0054.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. That's all very helpful.
Hopefully we can sell, maybe you can sell those, that new DVD at it. Mm-hmm. That would be good. And
yep.
Also sell.
You might want to get your order in today as soon as you can so that he can get you on the list.
Okay. All right. Sounds good.
Diana, could you just give me that email one more time?
Yes.
A little more slowly, please.
Yeah, okay. Slowly, yeah.
Okay. DianaHelene@gmail.com. It's DianaHelene@gmail.com.
Got it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Diana, for that. Any other announcements?
Yeah, this is Wayne here.
Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, so Cheryl Curtis and I have taken our Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group to the next level, and we formed a nonprofit called 9/11TruthOutreach.org. We're putting up a website, and it's going to be focused mostly on the architects and engineers evidence, and also moving to include the Pentagon issues pretty much focused on the Barbara Honegger explanations, which seem to make by far the most sense to most people that I've encountered. So we're looking to develop ways to reach out to many activists, and the goal is to get the flyers produced and distributed to the activists who have the time. So that's there's more to come. But if you want to see the current state of the website, you can go to 911truthoutreach.org. 911truthoutreach.org.
Wow,
that's all.
Congratulations. That sounds like a super step forward. Very good. All right. Any other announcements? Well, hearing none, since we've already gone through, but what? Go ahead.
Hang on, I have a question.
I'm sorry?
This is James. I have a question.
Go ahead, James.
Do we have any further information about contact with the Jersey Girls?
Well, that's Cheryl, and I asked Cheryl to wait on that. Because we already had a full vote for tonight, but
okay.
Cheryl, is there any word on that? Do you know anything more?
Hang on. No, I was going to wait until I can wait until next month, but I have Lori Van Auken's email, so I can contact.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's very promising. Great.
Okay.
So one more announcement.
Yes. Go ahead.
This is Hamook, 9/11 TV. Is everybody aware of the natsummit.org videos? Nobody. Okay. Natsummit.org has got 6 hours of video of the National Summit on the U.S.-Israeli Special Relationship, it was done by C-SPAN, and they did it too.
Yeah.
And
Yeah,
you've seen that. Okay, you're aware of it. Good. Anyway, I wanted to put that notice in the minutes of the natsummit.org videos.
Is Nat spelled with a G?
N-A-T.
Okay.
S-U-M-M-I-T, all one word.
Okay.
Yeah. Very, very good stuff. Very good stuff. So he'd like that in the minutes, Craig, if he can put that in there, okay?
Okay, and the videos, just repeat again what the videos deal with?
It's the U.S.-Israel special relationship, reassessing the U.S.-Israel special relationship. And there's people saying that the settlements are wrong and that we should stop sending them money and on and on. And they mention everything except 9/11, but I'm working on it.
Well, there's one Q&A where 9/11 got in Q&A only, but you've got people, CIA people like Ray McGovern, Phil Giraldi, you've got Cynthia McKinney and other people who got kicked out of Congress, and former ambassadors and former flag rank officers and other former congresspeople, this impressive bunch of people, 24 people speaking in all.
Yep. Okay. All right. Any other announcements then? Okay. We don't have time to review the list of topics that we said we wanted to keep tabs on. If anybody had anything to say about them, I think we probably would have thought it already. So We'll hopefully pick that up next time if there's slack in the call. But I think this call shows to go you that the 9/11 Truth Conference is whatever we make it, and a lot of people did a lot of work to make this one informative and 2 hours long. So thank you all for your participation and for the efforts that were made to put this one together, and we'll see you all the last Wednesday in July.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you.
Thanks for your work.
Thanks to everybody.